and revealed the whole secret to Adams, who, Abigail was happy to report, responded with a hearty laugh. Whatever pleasure they might have found in their expanded quarters was foreclosed before they ever reached home. Abigail was taken ill on the journey and confined to her bed from the day they arrived, August 8th. She was very weak, Adams wrote to Oliver Wolcott. Some days later, he reported to Timothy Pickering, "Mrs. Adams is extremely low and in great danger." In fact, she was as sick as she had ever been, and it was with difficulty that Adams was able to concentrate on anything else. Nabby, who with her daughter Caroline had come for an extended visit, hoping to be of help, wrote to John Quincy that it had become a different house. "The illness of our dear mother has cast a gloom over the face of everything here, and it scarce seems like home without her enlivening cheerfulness." To Secretary of War McHenry, Adams would describe it as the most gloomy summer he had known. But he could as easily have called it one of the most gloomy passages of his life, second only to his own siege of illness and despair in Amsterdam. Writing to George Washington later, after 2 months at home, Adams would say that Abigail's fate was still very precarious, and mine in consequence of it. Yet, to judge from the volume of correspondence, the number and variety of issues he dealt with, he worked no less diligently than usual, spending long hours at his desk in the new library across the hall from Abigail's sick room. Official reports from Philadelphia, dispatches from department heads, documents requiring his signature, requests for pardons, applications for jobs, reports of all kinds, arrived in assorted bundles daily by post rider. Decisions were called for on matters large and small. Benjamin Rush asked that his brother be considered for the Supreme Court. There was a request for the president's approval to build a lighthouse at Cape Hatteras, a request from Secretary Wolcott for authority to borrow up to $5 million on behalf of the United States, reports from Wolcott on the yellow fever epidemic. Secretary McHenry sent an extended review, numbing in detail, of expenditures required for the Department of War. "I have supposed that the items in the table of the quartermaster's supplies and contingent expenses for the 8 additional companies and privates to the old establishment and for the 6 additional companies of dragoons may be covered by the appropriations for the original army, and that the $600,000 stated by the quartermaster's department for the 12 regiments will procure all the camp equipage not provided for by the table." Nor was there any let-up in the stream of patriotic addresses. Adams struggled to read it all and respond. "Wooden walls have been my favorite system of warfare and defense for 23 years, he wrote in reply to an address from the Boston Marine Society. "Americans in general, cultivators as well as merchants and marines, begin to look to that source of security and protection." After reading Wolcott's report on the ravages of yellow fever at the Capitol, Adams sent an anonymous contribution of $500. Most pressing was an unfortunate dispute that developed between Adams and Washington. At the heart of the issue was whether Alexander Hamilton should be made the second highest-ranking officer in the new army, as Washington preferred and as Hamilton desperately desired. When McHenry had gone off by express stage to Mount Vernon in early July, he had carried, in addition to Washington's commission from the president, a letter from Hamilton about which Adams was told nothing. "The arrangement of the army may demand your particular attention," Hamilton wrote, referring to Washington's choice of a general staff. In this regard, Washington was advised that the judgment of the president ought not to be a consideration. "The president," Hamilton wrote, "has no relative ideas, and his prepossessions on military subjects in reference to such a point are of the wrong sort. meaning presumably that Adams cared more for the Navy than the Army. The view that Adams was unsuited to prepare the nation for war, and that Hamilton, by contrast, was the ideal choice for second in command, was shared by McHenry and Secretary Pickering alike. Indeed, Pickering had already said as much in a letter to Washington. Thus, both the Secretary of War and the Secretary of State were secretly campaigning for Hamilton, supplying him with inside information, and undermining the intentions of their president, whom they saw riding for a fall. Sending Hamilton copies of secret government documents that summer, McHenry attached a note saying, "Do not, I pray you, in writing or otherwise, betray the confidence which has induced me to deal thus with you or make extracts or copies. Return the papers immediately." Washington had accepted his commission in an entirely cordial letter to Adams, but with the understanding that as head of the new army, he could choose his own principal officers. Then he made known his intention to name Hamilton as second in command, with the rank of Major General. Since no one expected Washington to take the field at his age, or to command except in name, the proposed arrangement meant in effect that Hamilton was to be in command. It was to be Hamilton's army. In a letter that went off from Quincy to McHenry on August 29th, Adams wrote that Washington had conducted himself with perfect honor and consistency. "But the power and authority are in the president," Adams reminded his Secretary of War. "There has been too much intrigue in this business," he added, suggesting he knew more or suspected more than he appeared to. In a letter to Oliver Wolcott that he most likely never sent, Adams said angrily that were he to consent to the appointment of Hamilton to second rank under Washington, he would consider it the most reprehensible action of his life. "His talents I respect. His character I leave..." But Washington had left Adams no way out. To raise the new army, Washington's prestige was essential, as Hamilton, McHenry, Pickering, and Wolcott all understood. On September 30th, Adams relinquished the final say to Washington. September 30th was a Sunday, which makes it unlikely that the letter went off until the following day, October 1st, the same day Elbridge Gerry arrived home from France, bringing news that gave a very different cast to the whole picture. Gerry's ship appeared off Boston that morning. Losing no time, he dispatched a letter to Adams before the ship docked. But whether Gerry's letter reached Adams before Adams's letter went off to McHenry with the Morning Post is not known. "The French wanted peace," Gerry reported. 3 days later, on Thursday, October 4th, Gerry presented himself at Quincy, and he and Adams settled in for a long private talk. In his few days ashore, Gerry had been thoroughly ostracized in Boston. Not a hat was moved as he walked up State Street, according to one account from the Time. Angry crowds shouted insults outside his Cambridge home. But the welcome from Adams was warm, and the more Gerry talked, the more Adams must have realized that the current had turned his way at last. Talleyrand, Gerry assured him, was ready to treat seriously with the United States. It was a critical moment in Adams's presidency. Among other things, Gerry had more than justified Adams's confidence in him. What he was telling Adams, to be sure, was what Adams desperately wanted to hear. The last thing in the world Adams wished to do was to lead the country into a needless war. But more to the point, he judged quite correctly that Gerry was telling the truth. John Marshall had said much the same thing, and so had John Quincy in some of his correspondence with his father. But as Adams was to write, the assurances of Gerry, "my own ambassador," were more positive, more explicit, and decisive. Gary's letter of October 1st, Adams later said, confirmed these earlier assurances beyond all doubt in my mind, and his conversations with me at my own house in Quincy, if anything further had been wanting, would have corroborated the whole. It was the week after Gary's return when a letter arrived from Washington. Written on September 25th, it did not reach Adams until October 8th. Were he to be denied the deciding voice in the selection of his general staff, Washington informed the president, he would resign his commission. Adams sent off an immediate reply, agreeing to Washington's wishes. As he had accepted Washington's cabinet in the interest of unanimity, so he now accepted Washington's choice of Hamilton. But he also had reason to believe now that Hamilton and the army might not be needed at all. As a matter of form, he reminded Washington a bit lamely that by the Constitution, it was the president who had the authority to determine the rank of officers. Washington promoted Hamilton to be Inspector General. In the contest of who was in charge, Adams, it seemed, had been put in his place, outflanked not so much by Washington as by his own cabinet, and ultimately Hamilton, which left Adams feeling bruised and resentful. But at the same time, it gave Hamilton, and those in Adams's cabinet whose first loyalty was to Hamilton, an inflated sense of their own importance and authority. From continued discussion with Gary at Quincy, and from new dispatches from William Vance Murray at The Hague, Adams became convinced that Gary's conduct in Paris had not only been proper, but courageous. On October 20th, writing to Pickering to ask for suggestions on the content of his forthcoming message to Congress, Adams made it plain that he was thinking of sending a new minister to France, who may be ready to embark as soon as the president shall receive from the Directory satisfactory assurance that he shall be received and entitled to all the prerogatives and privileges of the general laws of nations. Further, he offered a list of those he had in mind for the assignment that included Patrick Henry and William Vance Murray. Then, in a letter to his Secretary of War expressing his full support for Washington's judgment, Adams added two pointed observations. Maintaining armies was costly business and could become quite unpopular in the absence of an enemy to fight, he reminded McHenry. Of what possible use could a large army be, Adams was saying, if a French invasion never took place? In closing, he observed, "At present there is no more prospect of seeing a French army here than there is in heaven." Abigail's illness dragged on. She never left her sickbed, her dying bed, as she said. Talk of sickness and death, of insomnia, melancholy, her persistent, baffling fevers dominated the domestic scene, just as sickness and death filled the newspapers week after week, as yellow fever spread in Boston, New York, Baltimore, and worst of all, in Philadelphia. By September, nearly 40,000 people had evacuated Philadelphia. Yet the newspapers continued to report more than 100 new cases a day. "The best skill of our physicians have proved unequal to the contest of this devouring poison," reported the Aurora. By the time the plague ran its course in Philadelphia, more than 3,000 lost their lives, including, as the Adamses were stunned to read, the mayor of the city and both Bache of the Aurora, who had died on September 10th at age 29, and his arch-nemesis, Fenno of the Gazette of the United States, who died just days before. The list of victims also included four of the servants at the president's house, as Abigail was duly informed. The melancholy that beset her was unrelenting, suggesting the fever she suffered may have been malaria. But she was also distressed over further troubles within the family. Before leaving on his diplomatic assignment abroad, John Quincy had left his savings, some $2,000, in the trust of his brother Charles. In the time since, however, Charles had managed to lose nearly all of it through bad investments, and then kept silent about what had happened, refusing to answer John Quincy's queries in the hope that with a little more time he might somehow recover at least part of the money. Only that summer had the truth become known within the family, and it was devastating to both parents, but especially to Abigail, who had so long and so diligently managed the family affairs. "I have not enjoyed one moment's comfort for upwards of 2 years on this account," Charles wrote to his mother in midsummer. "My sleep has been disturbed, and my waking hours embittered." "He is not at peace with himself," she would write later to John Quincy during her convalescence, "and his conduct does not meet my wishes. He has an amiable wife, 2 lovely children. I hope my letters will in time have their effect. I have discharged my duty, I hope, faithfully, but my dying bed was embittered with distress for the only child whose conduct ever gave me pain." Abigail was bedridden at Quincy altogether for 11 weeks. It was early November before she was well enough to come downstairs, and it was early November before Philadelphia was declared once more free of yellow fever. On November 12th, leaving Abigail behind, Adams headed off in the presidential coach behind 2 spirited horses and accompanied by his young nephew William Shaw, Billy Shaw as he was known, a recent graduate of Harvard who had been lame since birth and had lately become the president's secretary. "I strive to divert the melancholy thoughts of our separation, and pray you do the same," Adams wrote to Abigail at the end of his first day on the road. Chapter 10. Statesman. Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war. John Adams. Section 1. Adams was on the move again, gobbling up the miles. The weather was clear and cool, the road dry. "Our horses go like birds," he wrote. "Some days they made 30 miles. We glided along unforeseen, unexpected, and have avoided all noise, show, pomp, and parade," he reported to Abigail from Connecticut. He wrote nearly a letter a day. His teeth and gums ached. One side of his face was badly swollen. Yet, he assured her, he was neither fretful nor peevish. Indeed, the speed at which he moved, his joy in horses that could fly like birds, suggest he was heading for the capital knowing there was a way out of the impasse he had faced since taking office. That out of the gloomiest of times at home had come a first real sense that he might succeed after all in his main objective. A recurring rumor did much for his spirits. It was said a British fleet under Admiral Horatio Nelson had overwhelmed the French off the coast of Egypt. "Nelson's victory is mightily believed along the road," Adams wrote. If true, the chance of a French invasion of America had all but vanished. There was snow in New York, and the horses required a day's rest. Adams stopped to see his son Charles, but of this he wrote nothing. Crossing New Jersey, the horses flying again, they made 45 miles in a day, to arrive on November 24th in Philadelphia, where it was known for certain that Nelson had destroyed the French fleet at the Battle of the Nile 4 months earlier on August 1st. The city was in a bustle. Throngs of people were returning to resume daily life, opening boarded-up shops, airing out houses, scrubbing everything with a will now that the epidemic had passed. The weather was brisk. Congress was back. And to the delight of the city, George Washington had returned and could be seen coming and going from temporary headquarters at a boarding house on 8th Street. The general had entered Philadelphia on November 10th with full military flair, on horseback and in uniform, and accompanied by cavalry. Almost the whole of the military corps were drawn up on the commons to receive him, reported the Aurora, which had suspended publication following the death of Benjamin Bache, but was back in business under Bache's wife, Margaret. "This morning arrived in town the chief who unites all hearts," exclaimed another paper, the American Daily Advertiser. While the war fever of summer had by no means vanished like the yellow fever, the spirit of opinion heard in the shops and taverns and within the councils of government was noticeably more moderate, and in large part because of the British victory at the Nile. Albert Gallatin wrote to his wife that he felt an honorable accommodation with France was now within the power of the administration, perhaps even certain. Soon after his arrival, Adams met with a Philadelphia physician named George Logan, who had recently returned from France. As a Quaker and ardent Republican, Logan was not the sort of man Adams was known to favor. To Federalist war hawks, he was contemptible, since he had presumed to conduct his own peace mission to France. Roundly castigated as a dangerous, possibly disloyal meddler, Logan found it impossible to get a fair hearing within the administration. When he called on the Secretary of State to say he had been told by high officials in the French government that France was ready to make peace, Pickering gave him short shrift and showed him to the door. To see George Washington, Logan had accompanied a Philadelphia clergyman when he called at the house on 8th Street, but Washington had refused to speak to Logan, directing what few comments he had to the clergyman only. Adams, however, received Logan courteously, and tea was served. He had conversed directly with Talleyrand and a principal member of the Directory, Logan said, and they had expressed the wish to settle all disputes with America. Adams showed displeasure only once, when Logan insisted that the Directory was ready to receive a new American minister. According to Logan, Adams leaped from his chair, saying that only if a Republican were sent would the French receive him. "But I'll do no such thing," Adams said. "I'll send whom I please." "And whomever you do please to send will be received," Logan assured him. Whether he knew it at the time, Logan had made a strong impression. I had no reason to believe him a corrupt character or deficient in memory or veracity, Adams wrote later. Secretaries Pickering and McHenry remained certain that war was inevitable. Nonetheless, they joined the consensus among the president's advisers that, given the mood of the country and the Congress, a declaration of war at this point would be inexpedient. But it was also the unanimous conclusion of the cabinet that another mission to France would be an act of humiliation, and was therefore unacceptable. If there were to be peace overtures, they must come from France. Let a French mission cross the ocean this time. On December 7, 1798, Adams walked to Congress Hall, and in the presence of Generals Washington and Hamilton, Secretary of State Pickering, and both houses of Congress, he affirmed again America's need for defensive strength and America's desire for peace. The speech had been written by Pickering and Wolcott, and except for the addition of one phrase, Adams had made few changes. It must, he said, be left with France to take the requisite step of assuring that any American mission sent to Paris would be properly received. So while preparation for war would continue, Adams had signaled that the door to peace remained ajar. It was only a question of French intent and sincerity. The speech infuriated the Republicans and the Vice President, and no less was the anger of the high Federalists in Congress, who had expected a declaration of war. If Adams lacked the fortitude to take the step, then Congress would, they declared. But their efforts failed. Congress was not inclined to declare war. The martial ambitions of the Inspector General were undampened, however. With his new command, Hamilton dreamed now of grand conquest, with himself riding at the head of a new American army. The idea was to liberate Spanish Florida and Louisiana, possibly all of Spanish America, in a bold campaign combining a British fleet and American troops. First proposed by an impassioned apostle of Spanish-American freedom, Francisco de Miranda of Venezuela, the scheme had been around for years. Adams had learned of it and dismissed it out of hand. "We are friends with Spain," he had told Pickering. But the British had shown interest, and in secret, Hamilton had lately become involved, seeing possibilities for national empire and personal glory beyond the vision of lesser men. In a letter to one of his generals in Georgia, Hamilton stressed the need for a build-up of military supplies. "This, you perceive, looks to offensive operations," he wrote. "If we are to engage in war, our game will be to attack where we can. France is not to be considered as separate from her ally, Spain. Tempting objects will be within our grasp." Adams knew in general, if not in detail, what Hamilton, Pickering, and others were up to, and would later speak of it as a colossal absurdity. "The man is stark mad, or I am," he would remember thinking of Hamilton. But at the time he kept his own counsel, waiting to make his move. He wanted all to be still and calm, and told his department heads no more than they needed to know. For he understood now that their first loyalty was not to him. For someone supposedly suspicious by nature, Adams had been inordinately slow to suspect the worst of his closest advisers, and to face the obvious truth that keeping Washington's cabinet had been a mistake. Still, somehow, he must avoid a war and keep Hamilton from gaining the upper hand with his mad schemes. As Abigail had warned the summer before, that man would become a second Bonaparte. At the Navy Department and the President's house that December, with a foot of snow in the streets outside and sleigh bells sounding, Adams, Gary, McHenry, Secretary of the Navy Stoddart, and others gathered about large maps of the West Indies. Four squadrons, 21 ships in total, virtually the whole of the American naval force, were now assigned to the Caribbean. The largest squadron, which included the heavy frigates United States and Constitution, was under Commodore John Barry, who was admonished in his orders that a spirit of enterprise and adventure cannot be too much encouraged in the officers under your command. We have nothing to dread but inactivity. The fleet was to cruise the Lesser Antilles from St. Christopher, St. Kitts, to Tobago. San Domingo, Haiti, was to have increasing importance. Toussaint Louverture, leader of the slave rebellion on San Domingo, had written to Adams to suggest they become allies. Desperate for food for his starving troops, Toussaint wanted the American embargo lifted from the former French colony. In effect, he wanted recognition of the Black Republic, and Adams was interested. Thus, in December, a representative from Toussaint, Joseph Bunel, dined with Adams, marking the first time a man of African descent was the dinner guest of an American president. American ships would be welcome and protected in all San Domingo ports, Adams was told. John Quincy had earlier written his father to say he hoped something could be done for Toussaint, that he wished to see San Domingo free and independent. And with Secretary Pickering strongly of the same mind, Adams responded promptly. Commodore Barry was instructed to show himself with the greatest part of the fleet at Cape Francois to General Toussaint, who has a great desire to see some ships of war belonging to America. And the issue of de facto recognition, Toussaint's clause, would go before Congress. General Washington was rarely seen. He was working 7 days a week with Hamilton, drawing up plans for the Army, reviewing applications, and choosing qualified officers for 12 new regiments that were all still largely on paper. Satisfied with what had been accomplished, Washington departed the city for the last time on December 14th. Much had been said of Washington's cheerful demeanor. Even the Aurora commented on his good health and spirits, while Adams, by contrast, looked drawn and weary and was seldom cheerful. The old streak of irritability, his single flaw, according to Abigail, had been made worse by the presidency, as he himself acknowledged. He was weary from work, weary of conjectures, as he said. "If you come on, you must expect to find me cross," he had written to her in fair warning. It was not just that the work was unending, but that it was so tiresome. A peck of troubles in a large bundle of papers, often in a handwriting almost illegible, comes every day. Thousands of sea letters, commissions, and patents to sign. No company, no society. Idle, unmeaning ceremony. Adams's earlier proposal for Colonel Smith for the general staff had been turned down by the Senate, as had his proposed commission for Aaron Burr. Smith was unacceptable, Adams was told, because he was a bankrupt. This Adams had not denied, but praised his son-in-law as a brave and able soldier who had more than proven himself in the Revolution. Against his better judgment, Adams agreed to try again, this time nominating Smith for a colonel's commission, which, in spite of warm opposition, the Senate approved. In a letter to Smith telling him the news, Adams made clear what an embarrassment the whole business had been for him, and warned Smith bluntly that if unchecked, his pride and extravagances would bring ruin. His own children would be his undoing, Adams complained to Abigail. "My daughter and son, Charles, bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave if I don't arouse my philosophy. The daughter, too, without a fault. Unfortunate daughter, unhappy child." Snow fell again for several days. Christmas morning dawned clear and bright, and Adams succeeded in rousing his philosophy to a considerable degree. "There was no mistaking his age or the burdens of the presidency," he wrote to Abigail. "I am old, old, very old, and never shall be very well, certainly while in this office, for the drudgery of it is too much for my years and strength." But he took joy in the day. "It is Christmas and a fine day," he wrote. He had a cold, but it was over now. "I sleep well. Appetite is good, work hard, conscience is neat and easy, content to live and willing to die, hoping to do a little good." The vice president, having departed Monticello on December 18th and traveled dreadful winter roads north by public coach, arrived at Philadelphia that same Christmas morning in time for breakfast at the Francis Hotel. Jefferson had been absent for 6 months, during which he had raised no voice as head of the Republican Party, but had kept extremely busy, writing letters and secretly drafting a set of resolutions to be introduced in the legislature of Kentucky. Written in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts, Jefferson's Kentucky resolutions declared that each state had a natural right to nullify federal actions it deemed unconstitutional. The states were thus to be the arbiters of federal authority. At the same time, James Madison undertook a version of his own resolutions for Virginia. The Kentucky resolutions, which had passed in November, were an open challenge to the authority of the central government and a measure both of Jefferson's revulsion over the Alien and Sedition Acts and the seriousness with which he regarded states' rights. Possibly he failed to see the dire threat to the Union embodied in what he had written. but a letter he wrote to Madison strongly suggests otherwise. He was confident, Jefferson said, that the American people, with their good sense, would rally with us round the true principles of the Federal Compact. But, he wrote in chilling conclusion, he was determined, were we to be disappointed in this, to sever ourselves from the Union we so much value, rather than give up the rights of self-government. Tormented by the thought of his old enemy Hamilton riding high as Inspector General and federal power in the grip of a military enclave, Jefferson saw the country on the verge of civil war. He feared a federal army under Hamilton might march on the South at any time. His advice to Madison and other close associates was to stay calm and quiet. Firmness on our part, but passive firmness, is the true course, Jefferson cautioned after returning to Philadelphia. He was distressed also about the bill before Congress to lift the embargo on San Domingo and commence trade with the rebellious Negroes under Toussaint. When Toussaint's clause was passed, Jefferson noted bleakly, we may expect, therefore, black crews and missionaries pouring into the southern states. If this combustion can be introduced among us under any veil whatever, we have to fear it. It had been more than a year since the president and vice president had spoken to each other. Except for passing pleasantries at a few ceremonial occasions, conversation and correspondence between them had ceased. Had they been able to compare notes, they would have discovered how much more they shared in common than met the eye or than either had any idea. Both complained privately of poor health. They were each extremely lonely and longed for home. Much of what Jefferson wrote to his daughters from Philadelphia in the opening weeks of the new year, 1799, might have been taken from Adams's letters to Abigail. Jefferson battled a head cold and suffered from inflammation of the eyes. The circle of our nearest connections is the only one in which a faithful and lasting affection can be found, he wrote to Polly. And in a letter to Martha, he could hardly have sounded more like Adams in his own days as vice president. Environed here in scenes of constant torment, malice, and obloquy, worn down in a station where no effort to render service can avail anything, I feel not that existence is a blessing. But when something recalls my mind to my family or farm. Had Jefferson known Adams's mind at this juncture, he would have been quite surprised. Most striking was their common dislike and fear of Hamilton. The worries Jefferson had about Hamilton's threat to the nation were more than matched by Adams's, as Adams revealed in private conversation with Elbridge Gerry at the president's house. Adams thought Hamilton and a party were endeavoring to get an army on foot to give Hamilton the command of it, and thus to proclaim a regal government and place Hamilton as the head of it, and prepare the way for a province of Great Britain, wrote Gerry. Plainly, Adams feared a military coup by the second Bonaparte, which goes far to explain what was soon to take place. Closing his Christmas letter to Abigail, Adams said, I write to you nothing about public affairs because it would be useless to copy the newspapers which you read, and I can say nothing more. How much was implied by this, she could only try to imagine. 3 weeks later, in mid-January, to Adams's utmost joy, his son Thomas, now 27, arrived in Philadelphia after 4 years abroad. Thomas is my delight, he wrote. It was also of no small consequence that Thomas carried word from John Quincy, assuring his father that the French were ready to negotiate. Section 2. On Monday, February 18, 1799, Adams made his move. Having consulted no one, and without advice from Abigail, he took the most decisive action of his presidency. Indeed, of all the brave acts of his career, his defense of the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre trials, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, his crossing the Atlantic on the Boston in the winter of 1778, the high risks of his mission to Holland, one brief message sent to the United States Senate was perhaps the bravest. It was carried by a courier to the second-floor Senate chamber, where an astonished vice president interrupted the business on the floor to read it aloud. "Always disposed and ready to embrace every plausible appearance of probability of preserving or restoring tranquility, I nominate William Vance Murray, our minister resident at The Hague, to be Minister Plenipotentiary of the United States to the French Republic. If the Senate shall advise and consent to his appointment, effectual care shall be taken in his instructions that he shall not go to France without direct and unequivocal assurances from the French government, signified by their Minister of Foreign Relations, that he shall be received in character, shall enjoy the privileges attached to his character by the law of nations, and that a minister of equal rank, title, and powers shall be appointed to treat with him, to discuss and conclude all controversies between the two republics by a new treaty." The warmonger, who the summer before had refused to declare war, had declared, if not peace, then at least that the door to peace was now wide open. Republicans were astounded. Federalists were momentarily speechless, then filled with surprise, indignation, grief, and disgust. Particularly galling to them was the fact that it was Jefferson who read the message. The Secretary of State was enraged. "The honor of the country is prostrated in the dust. God grant that its safety may not be in jeopardy," Timothy Pickering wrote to George Washington. In a letter to William Vance Murray, Pickering would declare, "Every real patriot was thunderstruck. Adams," he said, "was suffering the torments of the damned. I beg you to be assured that it is wholly his own act," Pickering reported to Hamilton. Senator Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts, who had greatly admired Adams, worked for his election, and thought he had thus far played a noble part as president, felt personally betrayed. Barely able to control his fury, he wrote of the vain, jealous, and half-frantic mind of John Adams, a man ruled by caprice alone. "Had the foulest heart and the basest head in the world been permitted to select the most embarrassing and ruinous measure, perhaps it would have been precisely the one which has been adopted." Another riled Federalist, Robert G. Harper of South Carolina, Hamilton's chief spokesman in the House, privately expressed the hope that on Adams's way home to Quincy, his horses might run away with him and break his neck. Hamilton himself allowed that if anything coming from John Adams could astonish, certainly this had. To Thomas Jefferson, it was the event of events. But strangely, regrettably, he was unable to accept what Adams had done at face value, or to give him any credit. Rather, Jefferson took pleasure in the mortification of the Federalists, which proved, he said, that war was always their intent. To Madison, he wrote that Adams had only made the nomination hoping that his friends in the Senate would take on their own shoulders the odium of rejecting it. In the Aurora, Margaret Bache and her new editor, William Duane, would concede only that Adams deserved fair applause for prudence. But for all the indignant fuming of the high Federalists, no motions were made in the Senate for a resolution opposing a new mission to France. When a Senate committee led by Sedgwick came to see Adams a few days later, it was to object only to the choice of Murray, who was thought too young, not strong enough for an assignment of such importance. They wished to have the nomination retracted, which Adams refused to do. Murray was a man of experience and ability through whom communications with Talleyrand were already established, Adams answered. Further, Murray had the advantage of being on the scene. Accounts differ whether the meeting was amicable or acrimonious, but a compromise resulted in any event. Instead of Murray alone serving as minister plenipotentiary, Adams nominated Patrick Henry and Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth to join Murray as envoys to France, making a commission of three. The Senate immediately confirmed the appointments, and a day later, March 4th, Congress adjourned. Afterward, when Patrick Henry declined for reasons of health, Adams chose another Southerner, the Federalist Governor of North Carolina, William Davy. In Massachusetts, infuriated Federalists were saying that had the president's old woman been with him in Philadelphia, none of this would have happened, she being the more stout-hearted of the two. "This was pretty saucy," Abigail wrote to John of the Gossip, "but the old woman can tell them they are mistaken." She considered his decision a masterstroke. By the second week of March, as Adams was preparing to leave for Quincy, word reached Philadelphia that the American frigate Constellation, under Captain Thomas Truxton, had captured the French frigate L'Insurgent after a battle near the island of Nevis in the Leewards, the first major engagement of the undeclared war at sea. Where would it all end? People were asking in Philadelphia. But Adams was anything but alarmed or displeased. Of Captain Truxton, he wrote, "I wish all other officers had as much zeal." While his entire political standing, his reputation as president, were riding on his willingness to make peace, Adams was no less ardent for defense. In fact, he was convinced that peace was attainable only as a consequence of America's growing naval strength. To Secretary Stoddart, he even proposed that some of the fast new ships might be used to cruise the coast of France. "Nor do I think we ought to wait a moment to know whether the French mean to give us any proofs of their desire to conciliate with us. I am for pursuing all the measure of defense which the laws authorize us to adopt, especially at sea." Convinced he could run the government as well from Quincy as at Philadelphia, Adams stretched his stay at home from late March to September, fully 7 months. From the views expressed by his vociferous critics, it was hard to say which annoyed them more, his presence at the Capitol or his absence. At worst, his absence seemed an arrogant abdication of responsibility. At best, it seemed a kind of eccentric scholarly detachment. Some moderate Federalists and old friends warned Adams he could be doing himself and the country great harm by remaining too long in seclusion. "The public sentiment is very much against your being so much away from the seat of government. They did not elect your officers, nor do they think them equal to govern without your presence and control," wrote a correspondent who feared a plot against Adams could be hatching in his absence. "I speak the truth when I say that your real friends wish you to be with your officers, because the public impression is that the government will be better conducted." There had been criticism of his long absence the year before, irrespective of Abigail's illness. But the criticism now was greater, and with reason. Adams's presence at the center of things was what the country rightfully expected, and could indeed have made a difference. But stay he did at Peacefield, and to his mind with more than sufficient justification. Washington, too, had spent long sessions at Mount Vernon, though never for 7 months. And with Philadelphia hit by yellow fever every summer and fall, the government barely functioned there for several months. He could accomplish his work quite as readily at home as at the Capitol, so long as Congress was not in session. Were he ever unable to appear when Congress was sitting, Adams said, he would resign. He worked dutifully. He read everything that was sent to him, read several newspapers assiduously, wrote some 70 letters to his department heads during the time he was absent, 28 of which were to his Secretary of State. If there were delays in the system, they were nearly always at Philadelphia, not at his end. Beyond all that, Adams recognized there was only so much he could do, that he could affect the roll of events only to a point. Writing to Washington earlier, he had expressed much of his philosophy as president in two sentences. My administration will not certainly be easy to myself. It will be happy, however, if it is honorable. The prosperity of it to the country will depend upon heaven, and very little on anything in my power. Frequently he would interject a similar refrain in thoughtful letters to his department heads when passing down decisions or judgments on matters of government business. For Adams, the ultimate command rested always beyond the reach of mortal men. Just as the very natures and actions of men themselves were often determined by their Maker. In an official letter to Secretary of the Navy Stoddart, written the summer of 1799, Adams began, "It always gives me pain when I find myself obliged to differ in opinion from any of the heads of departments. But as our understandings are not always in our own power, every man must judge for himself." When Secretary of War McHenry stressed the importance to the nation of a substantial army and of genius in the command of it, Adams responded that genius in a general is oftener an instrument of divine vengeance than a guardian angel. In health and outlook, he always benefited from time on his farm, and Abigail's health, too, was soon greatly improved. Given his nature and so much that burdened his mind, he undoubtedly had moments of despair and anger. Once when General Knox and Adams's old friend from the years in Holland, Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse, came to call, Adams sat the whole time reading a newspaper. Still, he attended the Harvard commencement, a 4th of July celebration in Boston, and the launching of the frigate Boston. On July 23rd, Adams watched from an upstairs window as the Constitution headed out to sea from Boston under full sail. After a detention of 9 days by contrary winds, he wrote, the Constitution took advantage of a brisk breeze and went out of the harbor and out of sight this afternoon, making a beautiful and noble figure. According to Abigail, in a midsummer report to John Quincy, the president was in very good humor. Late in the day, August 5th, Adams received a dispatch from Pickering containing a letter from Talleyrand dated May 12th, assuring that the American envoys would be received with all appropriate respect. It was the word Adams had been waiting for. At his desk at Peacefield the next morning, he wrote a letter to Pickering, leaving no doubt of his intentions, his sense of urgency, or who was the senior diplomat between them, and that he expected immediate action taken. It was in all a strong summary of what had been his policy from the start. It also included a flash of Adams's temper in what he said in response to Pickering's umbrage over the impatience Talleyrand had expressed about the time the Americans were taking to get things moving. It is far below the dignity of the President of the United States to take any notice of Talleyrand's impertinent regrets and insinuations of superfluities, Adams lectured. You or Mr. Murray may answer them as you please. That said, Adams got to the essential point, lest Pickering have any misconceptions. I will say to you, however, that I consider this letter as the most authentic intelligence yet received in America of the successes of the coalition. That the design is insidious and hostile at heart, I will not say. Time will tell the truth. Meantime, I dread no longer their diplomatic skill. I have seen it and felt it and been the victim of it these 21 years. But the charm is dissolved. Their magic is at an end in America. Still, they shall find, as long as I am in office, candor, integrity, and as far as there can be any confidence and safety, a pacific and friendly disposition. If the spirit of exterminating vengeance ever arises, it shall be conjured up by them, not me. In this spirit I shall pursue the negotiation, and I expect the cooperation of the heads of departments. American defenses by sea and land were not to be relaxed. As to the mission, he wished to delay nothing. My opinions and determinations in these subjects are so well made up, at least to my satisfaction, that not many hours will be necessary for me to give you my ultimate sentiments concerning the matter or form of the instructions to be given to the envoys. Just as it seemed Adams had set his course, news came from Paris of a breakup of the Directory. Chaos, according to reports. To his cabinet, it brought a surge of hope that peace could be postponed, a view strongly reinforced by Inspector General Hamilton. Secretary of the Navy Stoddard, Adams's consistently loyal supporter, urged him to come at once to Trenton, New Jersey, where the government had set up emergency quarters until the yellow fever epidemic passed in Philadelphia. Although not inclined to go just yet, Adams told Stoddard that should considerable difference arise between the heads of departments, he would come at all events. On September 13th, Stoddard wrote again, filled with apprehension that artful, designing men might make such use of your absence as to disrupt the peace initiative and make your next election less honorable than it would otherwise be. This and a letter from Pickering proposing suspension of the peace mission were all Adams needed to hear. Abigail would follow once she had things in order at home. He would be in Trenton by October 15th at the latest, Adams wrote Stoddard. I have only one favor to beg, and that is that a certain election may be wholly laid out of this question and all others. Adams left Peacefield on the last day of September, ready for what he had to face. But stopping at Eastchester to see Nabby, he was struck a blow for which he was wholly unprepared. While the details are sparse, it could only have been one of the most dreadful moments of his life. To make matters worse, he had begun to feel ill en route and so arrived at Eastchester already in a low state. From his distraught daughter-in-law, Charles's wife, Sally, who with her two small daughters was staying with Nabby, Adams learned for the first time that Charles, who had disappeared, was bankrupt, faithless, and an alcoholic. "I pitied her, I grieved, I mourned," Adams wrote to Abigail in anguish, but could do no more. David's son Absalom at least had enterprise, he said. Mine is a mere rake, buck, blood, and beast. If he felt pity for Charles, he did not express it. I love him too much, Adams had once written of his small second son when they were in Paris. Charles wins the heart as usual and is the most gentleman of them all, he had said upon seeing him again after the return from England. Now Charles had become a madman possessed of the devil. And, declared Adams, I renounce him. As time passed, the Adamses would say comparatively little about Charles. It was as though the downfall of Abigail's brother William were repeating itself, and the family returned to the old ways of keeping calamity private. Only now and then would Abigail make mention of it usually in letters to Mary Cranch, and almost never referring to Charles by name. Any calamity inflicted by the hand of Providence, it would become me in silence to submit to, she wrote some weeks later. But when I behold misery and distress, disgrace and poverty brought upon a family by intemperance, my heart bleeds at every pore. A graceless child he was, but she did not renounce him. To push on to Trenton, loaded with sorrow, was almost more than Adams was up to. He felt wretchedly ill with a cold so severe that he thought he might have yellow fever, which he did not. Trenton, a village no larger than Quincy under normal conditions, was overflowing with refugees from Philadelphia, in addition to several hundred government officials and military officers. The best that could be arranged for the president were a small bedroom and sitting room in a boarding house kept by two maiden sisters named Barnes, one of whom provided the ailing Adams with a down comforter, while the other dosed him with a purgative of rhubarb and calomel. Adams arrived expecting to meet directly with his cabinet to straighten out the impasse on the mission to France, and as miserable as he felt, he was ready to summon them without delay. What he had not expected was the presence in Trenton of General Hamilton, who had come to make a personal appeal to Adams to suspend the mission. Hamilton had ridden over from Newark, where his troops were encamped and where by protocol he ought to have remained until called for, should the president wish to see him. That he had chosen to come to Trenton uninvited was taken by some as the kind of bold move Hamilton was known and admired for, but it also strongly suggested an element of desperation. Hamilton called on Adams at the Barnes boarding house, where presumably they drew up chairs in Adams's tiny sitting room. Two proud, pertinacious men who by now hated each other, one ambitious for war, the other peace, and each determined to have his way. According to Adams, who provided several accounts of the confrontation, then and later, he received the general with appropriate civility, saying nothing of politics. But at first chance, Hamilton commenced to remonstrate against the mission to France. His eloquence and vehemence wrought the little man up to a degree of heat and effervescence. He repeated over and over again his unbounded confidence in the British Empire with such agitation and violent action that I really pitied him, instead of being displeased. The British had the upper hand in the war, Hamilton insisted, and would soon help restore the Bourbons to power in France. America must join with the British and have no dealings whatever with the present French government. Adams was astonished by Hamilton's total ignorance of the situation in Europe. He would as soon expect the sun, moon, and stars to fall from their orbits as to see the Bourbons restored, he told Hamilton. But even were that to happen, what injury could it mean for the United States to have envoys there? The meeting lasted several hours, through which, by his account, Adams sat patiently listening as Hamilton, with his famous powers of persuasion, talked steadily on. I heard him with perfect good humor, though never in my life did I hear a man talk more like a fool. On October 15th, Adams summoned the cabinet to a session that lasted until 11 o'clock that night. Pickering, Wolcott, and McHenry, like Hamilton, adamantly opposed the mission. Secretary of the Navy Stoddart supported it, as did Attorney General Lee, the only member of the cabinet not present at Trenton, but who had expressed his views in a letter. Adams's decision was given the next morning, Wednesday, October 16th. 1799. The president has resolved to send the commissioners to France, wrote a thoroughly dispirited Hamilton to George Washington. All my calculations lead me to regret the measure. The commission sailed for France on November 15th. If Hamilton and his admirers in the cabinet had outmaneuvered Adams in the contest over command of the army, Adams had now cut the ground out from under Hamilton. Whatever dreams Hamilton entertained of military glory and empire, America was to have no need of either a standing army or a Bonaparte, which, it is fair to say, was as clear an objective in Adams's mind as was peace with France. Section 3. "I enclose the speech," Abigail wrote to Mary Cranch. "It has been received here with more applause and approbation than any speech which the President has ever delivered." She was reinstated in the President's house and in the President's life, resuming her role where she had left off, despite all she had been through, and all Mary knew she suffered because of Charles. There would be grumbling over the speech, Abigail wrote. There would always be grumbling, she had come to understand. Addressing a joint session of the new Congress at the usual noon hour, December 3, 1799, Adams had delivered the most moderate, peaceable speech since his inaugural message, stressing a pacific and humane American stance before the world. Gone were calls for a new navy or a new army. Though the measures adopted to secure our country against foreign attacks must not be renounced, the national defense must be commensurate with our resources and the situation of our country. War drums were out of season.